tracing the way home through memory, history, race, and the American landscape.
Most simply, the book really is a search for how the unvoiced past marks a person, in this case me, but also marks a people and marks the American land. And in this case, the traces were about finding home in this country.
That's scientist and writer Laurette Savoy. We spend the hour talking with her about her stunning new book, Trace. Thanks for joining us on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Looked at from a cultural perspective, Laurette Savoy could be the quintessential American. Her ancestry mixes African-American, Euro-American, and Native American heritages, an inheritance shrouded in silence for much of her childhood. Her path to trace that heritage is recounted in her beautiful new book, Trace: Memory, History, Race, and the American Landscape. Savoy is a digger into the depths. She's an earth scientist and cultural historian who reads the palimpsest of time in the geological record, deciphering the traces of history, human and wild. She's also an eloquent storyteller whose lyrical language evokes the meanings contained in landscape, meanings that speak above all of the relationships between us and all that surrounds us. As professor of environmental studies at Mount Holyoke College, Laurette Savoy is acutely attuned to the relationship between us and the land, a relationship that must be founded on a moral bedrock if we're to survive. But she also traces the connections between us and those who have gone before us, not just in history, but in her own personal story. Savoy explores these relationships between humans and the land in her new book. Kirkus Review said of Trace, "Springing from the literal earth to metaphor, Savoy demonstrates the power of narrative to erase as easily as it reveals, yielding a provocative, eclectic expose of the palimpsest historically defining the U.S. as much as any natural or man-made boundary." Well, Laurette Savoy, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you very much for asking me. I'm honored to be here with you.
This book, Trace, was so beautiful and powerful and moving, a real delight to read. I'd like to start out by asking you to describe to us what that word trace means to you in the vision of this book.
I wanted to find a title that was simple and direct and that was a word that wasn't a hard word in that it didn't end with a hard sound, an abrupt sound. I wanted something that trace, that left room for thinking, for pondering, as if the word itself hadn't ended. And in this case, I wanted a title that could be taken as a verb and a noun, the action as well as the action being described. And so in this case, it indicates in the book the very active search that I undertake, the paths of the journeys that I took, but also the tracks and vestiges of what once was. And if I could just say most simply, the book really is a search for how the unvoiced past marks a person, in this case me, but also marks a people and marks the American land. And in this case, the traces were about finding home in this country. And that is trying to place myself, or place oneself, not only in the land, but in time, across generations and in history. So trace, the search, the paths I took, as well as the pieces of the past that I tried to find.
It is a remarkable journey. And you start the journey with the Grand Canyon, one of my favorite places, a place that I both traversed the upper cliffs of, and also the river. It was a trip that you took out there when you were seven. Is it true you were moving east from California at that time? Is it the same trip or a different one when you moved east?
No, it's very much the same trip, and it's the memory of that trip is truly embedded. It's so deeply embedded, and it really defined so much of the choices that I made later in life. If I could just describe it, my father and my mother are from the east. And my father had moved to California as one of the last attempts to craft a life far from Washington, D.C. And I would say that I was born at the elastic limit of his attempt to live far from home. And for me, because I was born on the West Coast, and as a child, taking in the environment on the West Coast, that was home. And so when they decided, or my father decided, to move to the East, I felt that I was being uprooted from my origins. And I mean that in the most direct sense. You know, children have self-theories about how they come to be, who they are. And my self-theory had been that sun flowed in my veins, or that blue sky flowed in my veins, and that sun made my skin. And we had visited the East Coast before, and I couldn't understand because it was so humid, so faded. So it was the trip, the move from West Coast, my home, to the East Coast, their home. And stopping at the Grand Canyon, at the north end of the Grand Canyon, was a chance to see vastness unimagined before, yet a chance to recognize that the land could welcome me, as only a seven-year-old could think of it. So it was a very important journey, one that I've held on to. The rocks that I collected on the trip, the postcards that I collected, I still have them, and I still have to go back and touch them as if I were touching that past.
Now, you are of mixed ancestry, black, white, and Native American. I think you hit the trifecta there, the American trifecta. Your father was very light-skinned and could pass for white but didn't. So talk a little bit about what you mean when you say he was trying to go as far away as he could from Washington, D.C., and then why did he find himself back home?
I think that as a young man, he was in the Second World War. He served in the Army Air Corps. And after the war, he had written a novel that was published by one of the big New York presses, E.P. Dutton. And the novel got a lot of press at that time. And it was about a young boy, a boy who looks white, mulatto, using the term of the day, who tries to decide how best to make his way in the world. Should he pass or should he honor or acknowledge publicly his African-American ancestry? In the book, the boy chooses to pass as white. In real life, my father didn't. And I think that he, in so many instances, was disappointed by what he experienced in Washington, his home, and the home of his family for generations. Because if you saw him, if you looked at him, you would treat him, you would expect that he is a white man. Yet any time that he admitted, quote-unquote, Negro blood, the jobs that he would get were lost. And so even though he had qualifications, even though he could do the work, he wasn't given the chance. And so he did. He traveled across country to what some people call the land of milk and honey to find a new start, to make a new start. Because he never told me when I came along, and I came along after they had moved to California, it seems that disappointment found him there, that perhaps in some ways he couldn't make a go of it in a way that was full of dignity in terms of his making a life on his own terms. And I think partly because his parents were then ill and then they passed away in Washington, because he thought with changing administrations, and again, this is in the 1960s, he thought that he could try again in the East. And so we did. We came back.
He didn't talk much about that. In fact, you didn't even know that he had written and published this novel until after he died, and you were going through his things and you found a box that was a pretty rich trove for you.
You're right. I found the box. I only found the box in recent years, about a decade ago, but I learned about that book in college at the end of my first year there. I attended Princeton University, and I remember it was May, the semester was over, and I was just perusing the catalog. And at that point, Princeton still had the card catalog. It was just starting to move to an online system. And I don't know if you remember flipping through the cards in the catalog, just going through, what can I find? Who's there? Anyone I know? And I was in the S's, and I looked up Savoy, and I thought, well, let's see if there's anyone I know, someone from family. And then I saw Willard Wilson Savoy, and I was floored. I had no idea. And so I found the book. It was in the basement stacks of the library. And I started reading it. And this, again, was a novel that he had written about as a young man, far more than a decade before my birth, about the young man trying to make his way in the world. And the opening, the inscription or the dedication to the book says, and I don't have the words right in front of me, but that he hopes that at some point his child, when he has that child, would come to understand the choices he made in life and what it means to be a citizen of color in this country. And this was so important, Francesca, because he had passed away just about 2 years earlier. And after he died, I was lost. I didn't know who I was. I didn't know who he was. I didn't know our family past. And it was a clue. It was a clue. But I also have to say that when I started to read the book, I had to put it away too many times because I was afraid, because so many of the experiences that he describes in the book were also experiences that I had gone through, about being rejected, about being spat upon, about being denied or condemned simply because of appearance. And it was only later as an adult that I had a better understanding of who he was. And then finding the box years later, finding not only the manuscript to that novel, but finding manuscripts to other novels that were not published, as well as journal notes and photographs extending back over a century, it was a landmine, or a gold mine. And actually, it was a landmine, because it blew up my perceptions of everything I knew or did not know about family. And one thing that I did come to understand, and that I didn't realize growing up, because my father never wrote when I was a child, but that he, earlier in the 1950s, had defined himself as a writer. This is what he wanted to be. It's what he wanted to do. Yet, after the publishing of that first novel, he was under contract for two more by E.P. Dutton. And that second one, and pieces of that manuscript were in the box, that second one concerned a quote-unquote Negro artist who is fed up with the hypocrisy in the nation's capital, this land of freedom, yet a segregated city that denied the access to freedom to so many of its African-American citizens. And he also then is trying to decide what is the best way, and he's being teased by communism, whether or not that might be a better way. And of course, he's writing this in the early mid-1950s, at the time when McCarthy is doing his best to try to blacklist not only authors, but those who are defined as communists. And so, of course, E.P. Dutton never published that book. Never. They told him that he was writing something that was untrue and that had to be rejected, and they dropped his contract. And I don't think he ever wrote again or ever wrote concertedly. Maybe he did in snatches after I was born, when I had gone to bed, but it wasn't something that was part of our lives at all, publicly or visibly part of my life. And so I find this box a decade ago that shows a man that I did not know as a child. And what it also showed was that man whom I did not know was very close to me in dreams and wishes and desires. But when he was alive toward his later years, he died when I was 16, going on 17, our relationship was fraught. It was not good because I thought he did not approve of me, that everything I did was not good enough. And I realize now that he was simply trying to prepare me to live a life in a segregated world, even after the civil rights movement. And I realize now that we had a lot to say to each other. So one of my future book projects, and maybe I can describe this later, is engaging in dialogue with the pieces that I found in that box, the unpublished manuscripts, the journal notes, the scraps of writings that are on everything from napkins to matchbook covers to typed out papers, but again, trying to piece them together in a conversation that he and I could not have at that time, but that we can have now.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Laurette Savoy. Her book is Trace, Memory, History, Race, and the American Landscape. You know, I'm very struck by something you just said, which is piece together. And there's another term that you use in the book a lot, and that's remembering. Tell us what that means to you.
When I was in high school, I had to take several years of Latin and went to a Catholic high school. And I have always been interested in the roots of words. Where do they come from? Because so often, as they're used now, they only touch the surface of what original meanings were. And when I think of remember, I think of remember. Member in the sense of putting the pieces together. And remembering for me is not just recollection or recalling, but in recollecting, it is gathering fragments that may be disparate, may be spread apart, to put together into a narrative that might be coherent and understandable today. And so for me, remembering is not only piecing together the fragments that I've done in my work as a geoscientist, that is the fragments from fossils and rocks and the chemical elements of sediments, to then understand or interpret an ancient past on Earth. But it's also remembering or piecing back the fragments that I can find of my past, of my family's past, and also the past on this country, to give, at least for me, a larger sense of who I am as a citizen of that country, but also, as I said earlier, placing myself within the land's geography and across time, across generations. And for me, remembering has been vital because I grew up in a family of silence, but I grew up being bombarded by images that came from the media and also school lessons that presented a very one-sided or stereotypical or ignorant sense of what it means to be African American. And I knew that there were multiple dimensions that had been deflated or compressed into the flatness of a single piece of paper, and there had to be more. And so for me, I needed to remember in as many ways as possible that past into present to understand more of who I am and who I come from and what I come from. I think another aspect of remembering or piecing back together the fragments really comes from what I learned in trying to work on this book. And one of the key lessons that I learned was that to inhabit this country means to be marked by residues of its still unfolding history. And it's a history that's very much weighted by tangled ideas of race and of the land itself. And so what I needed to do was to not only understand the silences that have been within my family and that are within American society and the history told, and these silences for the latter two are largely a legacy of racism, but I needed to push back against the silences. I needed to articulate, and I think of articulate in different ways, but they ways that work together, and that's both in trying to join back together the unvoiced past in my life and in this land, but also trying to give clearer expression to that past. And so for me, remembering or piecing together the fragments had to be an alternative to erasure. And I have to say, as a child becoming an adult, I began to think that I was being erased by the images, media images that I noted before, by lessons taught, and by the silences within my family. And it really comes down to a past that's being and has been broken and pitted by gaps that the silences have left. And the gaps include losses of language and voice. I speak English. That's really my only language, despite schoolgirl ramblings in Latin and Castilian Spanish and French. I don't speak languages of African ancestors. I don't speak or know languages of Native ancestors. English is what I know. And I've also was silenced in some ways by the many types of human displacements that occurred due to dispossession of homeland from Native peoples, and also the forced servitude that slavery involved. And it also was a silencing that that reduced, as I mentioned earlier, I think immeasurable dimensions of lives that were flattened and compressed and deflated by ignorance and stereotype, and also by the very dismembering narratives of who we, and I put we in quotes, are to each other and in this land. There's so much more to it, yet it's not commonly known. And I needed to find where I fit in within that more.
And one of the more hidden parts of your heritage was your Indian heritage. You go to an island in Lake Superior, now called Madeline Island, called something else by the people who were originally there. Tell us a little bit about the man who named it Madeline Island and how that's an example of this flattening that you talk about.
I think one of the, if I could give a little prelude to that story, I had been invited to Madeline Island by a dear friend who has a cottage there. And it was a time not long after I had found my father's box. And I wanted to find a space, a quiet space, and preferably a place that I did not know that could be a stage or backdrop for opening that box. But what I found in being in that place, a place I had never visited before, I should say that what I found being there was that my ignorance of the place's history, of its landscape, and the layers of name meant little, if anything, connected me to that place. Madeline Island would simply be where I entered my father's box. But I came to learn, especially through reading the works of Anishinaabe author, scholar, cultural thinker Gerald Visner, that past of the place touched me, even though I didn't know it. And so I learned that the island, of course, was named by later explorers, French and English people who came, and that the original name, and I cannot pronounce it correctly, but it's a long Anishinaabe name that means the island of the golden-breasted woodpecker. And it's an island that was the indigenous home, the central home to an Anishinaabe group. And what I came to found, Francesca, in this is that so many stories that drove my interest from second grade through fifth grade and on through college and graduate school had origins in the stories that were both told there and imposed there. A case in point is that one of the people who named so much there is a man named Henry Rowe Schoolcraft, who is credited with discovering the origin of the Mississippi River. He's also credited with being one of the early experts on the land's indigenous peoples. He collected their quote-unquote myths and made them accessible to Americans back east. He even named the Anishinaabe Ojibwa, not a name that they gave themselves. Yet his work has been considered so much of the foundation of American ethnography. And I learned in fifth grade that this man was an intrepid explorer, a great geologist, an authority of American Indians. And so I thought he was a hero. And I wrote a fifth grade report on this hero's exploits, noting everything, but not realizing that what I was presenting was an unquestioned sequence of events. I didn't recognize any complexity or contradiction in the man's life. I didn't realize that so much of what he put forward was given to him by Anishinaabe peoples there and was taken by him, appropriated, changed, transmuted, translated. And then one of the pieces of that was Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's poem, The Song of Hiawatha, which I learned in second grade. And that, again, was taken by what Schoolcraft had then translated and taken out of context. But when I learned that poem, I learned it and thought of it as a real Indian story. And what's really amazing from that is that so many other people believed it to be the same way. And the song was translated into dozens of different languages, and that many different translators across the world accepted that poem as being faithful to its indigenous origins, and then they translated it into different languages, into Hebrew, into Russian, believing that it itself was a true indigenous story.
Wasn't it also translated into Ojibwa?
Yes, yes, you're right. That's one of the most glaring ironies of tangled fiction, because it was translated back from English into not just Ojibwa, but to quote-unquote Chippewa by a Canadian Pacific Railroad official for an outdoor play casting Native peoples as players, and that the author even invited Longfellow's daughters to receive or be received as honorary tribal members. And a newspaper of the day presented this as a marked homage to Native peoples because they have done wisely, because they're honoring this poem that is both a beautiful memorial to them and an eloquent plea for them. But it was taken so fully out of their original tribal context. Mm-hmm. And the last thing I learned that points to my work in geology was that so much of what happened there that drove Schoolcraft's work was driven by American government trying to find minerals, copper and iron, which were very, very much there in that area, and that the Anishinaabe people were dispossessed by homeland. Step by step, they lost their land as particular lands were found to be rich in copper. And the copper search, the iron search, and other minerals, gold, etc., drove the early explorations of geology. And so I didn't even realize that so much of geologic knowledge that is taken for granted was very much implicated with the dispossession of land of Anishinaabe peoples in search for copper and other minerals. So my love of native tradition in part was driven by that first encounter with the Song of Hiawatha, and my drive to understand the Earth's past, geology, was also in part implicated by how geologic exploration was tied to mineral exploration, which itself was then tied to the removal of Native peoples from traditional homelands that were found to be be rich in those minerals.
Laurette Savoy. We'll talk more about her new book, Trace: Memory, History, Race, and the American Landscape. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're spending the hour today with earth scientist, environmental studies professor, and writer Laurette Savoy. Her new book, Trace, is a provocative mosaic of personal journeys and historical inquiry across the American continent and in time. You say that so much of history neglects our relationships to each other. And you're arguing for a history that does not neglect our relationships. And I wonder if you could deepen our understanding of what you mean by that.
A really dear friend once asked me if history is more about forgetting and deletion, that is, eraser, than about remembering and completion. And what I came to understand in doing my work as an earth historian and as an educator is that the annals of Earth's past are very fragmented. They're very incomplete. So much of what we can find and what is accessible is just a small percentage of all that happened. And so what I came to understand is that the past that I've emerged from is also broken and pitted by great gaps. And this unvoiced past is in part a measure of history being not only what happened, but it's being the stories that have been told about what's happened. Mm-hmm. And stories, or some stories, that have been privileged as being the dominant stories, the ones that are told, cannot include everything. Choices are made to make a story. What is valuable to include? What should be left out? And it's the same with memory. When you think of, let's take our day, the day that began this morning, the rush of experience from everything that happened from the moment we woke up to today, we don't remember everything. We try to decide that one thing is important, another thing is important, the rest of it doesn't matter. And so we think of the stories that are told of the past. I started to imagine, what are the rest of the things that did not matter to those who were telling the stories that then became the prominent historical narratives that found their way to textbooks, to public history? So much of what happened was left out or was considered insignificant or was erased or was silenced in all the rememberings between the past to the moment those histories were written. And I know that my ancestors and parts of so many people's ancestors on those continents have been part of the histories or the narratives that were not included. And so what I was trying to do was try to trace the fragments, whether they were marks left on the land, whether they were the names of those who appeared in transcripts of ownership by the enslaver, noting the property not only of land of in person, but of in person, whether it was the names that are put on the land, but trying to trace those elements that are not commonly part of what is considered standard history today that is publicly known, yet still are important even though they're not known.
And this really came home for you in Washington, D.C., where you did some exploration of your own family, You situate the reader at the inauguration of President Obama in 2009, and you make reference to the secret city that Washington harbors. You did some exploration into that secret city in your own family. You were told by an aunt that no one in your family had ever been slaves. And then, what happened?
And then I learned that she might have been wrong in one case. And my aunt was one of the only people in my father's family to say anything about her past, that she said that our family had never been enslaved and that we actually owned land early on in Silver Spring. But she told me those things when I was about 12 years old. Mm-hmm. And I didn't quite understand what she was trying to say, but I realized that these were things that I needed to remember. I very much needed to remember. And what I learned, if it's all right to describe what I did with my cousin, I confided to my aunt's daughter that I had a great longing to know origins, to know where I came from, of who we were to each other, of who we were to this landscape, the landscape around Washington, D.C., which includes the coastal plain, the tidewater rivers, the Piedmont lands upstream of the tidewater rivers, that is upstream of the fall line. And I wanted to not so much respond to her mother's declarations, not so much to verify their truth, but to find some thread that would connect them to me, connect the place to me, to explain me. And then my cousin said, oh, you need to meet Buddy, because he's working on the family history. And I said, well, who's Buddy? And she said, he's your cousin. And he lived in the city as well. And I had never met the man. I didn't even know he existed. And I can't say why I didn't know of him beyond chalking it up to another example of the family silences. But I met Buddy, and we found that we both had a deep need to trace our past. And so one of the things that we did together was to go to the National Archives, because Buddy had found our third great-grandmother, Eliza, and she appeared in paper records of the home of a man who worked at the Washington Navy Yard, which was a big thing back in the early 1800s. It was perhaps the city's largest employer at the time, and he was a purser, meaning he was one of the chief financial officers. And so we went to the archives to look through the records, and what we found in boxes were his will and his estate inventory and different things. But we didn't know where Eliza fit in any of this. So we opened the box, and our white gloves picked up the dusty materials, and we handled page after page, and Buddy took half, and he read the will, and I took the estate inventory. And so I read through it pages after pages. I mean, the man was very well-to-do. And so along with parcels of land, a house, and items that included carpeting and very, very rich furniture, library cases, an estate map, globes of the world, copies of the Declaration of Independence, and more. But then at the very last page, on the third to last entry of an inventory that was valued at only, at this point, over $17,000, I found Eliza Savoy, $300. And below that, other servants are listed, and the subscribers certified the justness and truth of this inventory and evaluation of the goods, chattels, and personal estate of Timothy Wynn. And so at that point, the quiet of that room really caught my breath. Here is our third great grandmother inked in by name as property of a dead man to be disposed of by the terms of his will. And by learning that, we learned that my aunt might have been wrong in at least this one case, but what it did was drive me, drive my cousin, and drive other cousins that we found later on in the process of searching, other Savoy relatives whom we didn't even know, yet who too were seeking to search for the past. And we found quite a bit of it, a bit that's quite surprising.
You found, in fact, that in some ways your family history is on the three sides of the history of slavery, both as slave in the case of Eliza Savoy, also possibly, I mean, somewhere along the place there must have been a master in your history, and abolitionism.
Yes, and somewhere along the line there may have been more than a single master. And one thing that I can note is that her two sons are or were listed as free African Americans and noted as free mulattoes, meaning they were of mixed heritage, in the beginning in the 1850 census. So we have no idea of what Eliza's heritage was, but we can imagine one working hypothesis of whom a father was of those boys. Mm-hmm. But we also found that one of those sons, Edward Savoy, married a young woman who was also a free mulatto, Elizabeth Butler Savoy. And if you look at census records, they really don't say much about who the people are. They at most will give their profession. And for African Americans, professions were listed very simply as, let's say, laborer in his case, or washerwoman in her case. But then another, I guess, trace came out of the blue in that I found by accident an old article written by a researcher on the free Negro population of the city. And there's one sentence in there that mentions Elizabeth Butler Savoy, Edward's wife, as being a woman who aided the Underground Railroad. And so this gave far more dimension to her life and said far more about what kind of person she was than a census record listing her as washerwoman ever could. So now I'm trying to trace who she really was, because that author, he's long dead, and that research paper didn't leave any notes. And so again, it's trying to uncover any little piece that might give more of a sense of who not only she was, but who all of these different people were, because they weren't just enslaved. Many of them were free long back, even into the 18th century. And this is work that I have found out since working on this chapter, this last chapter on Washington in Trace. And in fact, what I found is driving one of my next writing projects, and that's tracing the family history in the larger context of the settlement of the Chesapeake area, Maryland, Virginia, including the city of Washington, but extending it back in time. And I have found some amazing, let's say, stories that I couldn't even thought of before finding this, going back into the mid-18th century and even earlier.
Well, now, I just wanted to be clear. So the woman who helped slaves escape on the Underground Railroad was actually the same woman who had been listed as property worth $300?
It was her daughter-in-law.
That's right.
Her daughter-in-law.
Right.
It seems that Eliza and Elizabeth are very common names, and as with many names over different generations, the same name is used again and again. In this case, the woman who is listed as property worth $300 had two boys. One of them, my great-great-grandfather, is Edward Savoy, and his wife is Elizabeth Butler Savoy. And she was the one who was listed as someone who aided the Underground Railroad.
Now, you are a geoscientist, and a lot of your sensibility as a geoscientist informs this wonderful book, Trace, Laurette Savoy. You write also about the kind of, it's not just history as a way of recognizing our connections to each other, but also land. Of course, land is not really separate from history, but you talk about it in terms of some of the work of Aldo Leopold, his writing Sand County Almanac, which you first discovered in the ninth grade. And he talks about a land ethic. You introduce three words, alien, land, and ethic. Each one has its own sentence, basically. And you talk about the morality that he feels we need to have, our place of connection to the land, to the earth. And you've introduced a larger concept of connection. So I wonder if you could just trace that out for us.
Two books published in 1949, what I'd like to say, published midway through the first century of world wars, have two key words in each of them that I think really are two words that need to be brought together, but there's a distance between them. Alien Land was the title of my father's book, a book that faces the legacy of racism that extended up into 1949 and, of course, continues today. And in Aldo Leopold's Sand County Almanac, the very last chapter of his book presents the land ethic in the sense that the land writ large, and this is what he meant. He meant everything about the land, the soils, the waters, the organisms living on that are all part of the land, and that we should treat the land in a way that we treat human beings. And as a child, when I was 14, reading that book, I understood that, but I also recognized that, well, the treatment of human beings in this country today is fraught with difficulty, that enslavement, that dispossession from homeland of native peoples, that the internment of Japanese American citizens during the Second World War would not be the way that I would treat human beings ethically or morally. So what is the distance between them, and how can that distance be closed up? And as a child at 14, trying to make that connection, growing to be an adolescent in college at the point when I found my father's book, as that adolescent becoming an adult, I felt very little integrity or wholeness of living because so much of what I was taught, so much of my acquired knowledge came from inculcated divisions. Mm-hmm. And I realized that only slowly would I be able to change things, that is, I would remain complicit in my own diminishment unless I stepped out of this separate trap, me from you, us from them, brown skin from depigmented skin, relations among people from relations with the land. Now, Aldo Leopold was concerned about the inadequacies of disintegrated thinking and living, but he was also concerned about the primacy of utilitarian values, of land being thought of something that could be used. Mm-hmm. And you could also think that in America's past, some human beings were considered entities that could be used from what could be gained from their labor, from their land. And what I've wanted to do was try to understand how a sense of a coordinated whole that included humans, biota, and the land itself. And I don't know how to say this really, really succinctly because so many ideas are churning for me, but I think what comes to mind is another book that I read at the same time. As a 14-year-old, it was Viktor Frankl's Man's Search for Meaning that he wrote after his own internment in concentration camps during the Second World War. And it was a book that was assigned by the Sisters of Providence in my high school, just as they had assigned All the Leopolds, the Sand County Almanac. And that one of Frankel's ideas, one of many that stayed with me, is that each man is questioned by life, and he can only answer to life by answering for his own life. To a life, he can only respond by being responsible. And that he went on to say that everything can be taken from a man but one thing, and the last of the human freedoms, and that is to choose one's attitudes in any given set of circumstances, to choose one's own way, and thus evoke his will to meaning from a state of latency. And so I thought, well, what did his words mean of choice for someone like me, for a 14-year-old, for an 18-year-old? Could one choose between ignorance and innocence? Could one choose to pick one and not the other? And I came to understand that what all the Leopold was trying to put forth in his land ethic, and what my father was trying to argue in Alien Land, really were two pieces of the same thing. The relationships that we owe to the land and the relationships that we owe to each other. And they're not separate. They can never be separate. And that they're thought of as separate is an artificial division. And so what I tried to then understand was how I could refrain from disintegrated thinking and living, from a fragmented understanding of human experience on this continent. How could I separate, or that's not the best word, how could I bring together or have alien land and land ethic meet and answer to each other in my lifetime, or if not in mine, in ones down the future? Because I honestly believe that each of us is questioned by life, and we are held to account. And this is one of the things of responsibility, as Viktor Frankl mentioned, that I think is important. And in this sense, again, going back to a root of the word, responsibility means the ability to respond, the capacity to attend, to stand behind one's acts. And this is one aspect where I think I do have the ability to respond. And this response is what I try to present in Trace.
Well, that is wonderful, and a wonderful place to end this profound interview. This is such an amazing book, Trace, Memory, History, Race, and the American Landscape. And I want to thank you so much for talking with us here about this important book.
And Francesca, I want to thank you for wanting to talk with me, but also for asking the important questions. I'm deeply grateful for that. You've given me a chance to give voice to what means a lot to me and to what I've not been able to articulate before now. It's wonderful to have a chance to speak out now.
Laurette Savoy. A week after we recorded this phone interview, I traveled to Western Massachusetts and got to meet Savoy in person. I asked her to read a selection from her book, Trace. Here's the prologue.
Prologue, Thoughts on a Frozen Pond. In the dead of winter, I like to walk on water, held above liquid depths of the nearby lake by a vast frozen plain. This ice demands respect. I look again, I listen again, attentive to any crack or yielding to my weight. When the surface is more solid than a hardwood dance floor and much thicker, I venture far. Even then, I hear the gloop, a distant blurp, a muffled gloosh, water undulating beneath ice and me. Sunlight appears to emanate from above and below on cloudless February days, raying through the crystalline lattice underfoot. With my eyes but inches from the surface, any sense of depth, of refracted distance, yields to a sense of motion arrested. Air bubbles halt in mid-ascent. White oak leaves descend as if on invisible steps, suspended for a season above the lake bottom. The recent past lies beneath me in these leaves, plucked and blown here by January's heavy winds. Inches away, they are out of reach. I kneel within the next stratum. Thoughts of time's passage always come to mind on such walks, thoughts of how memory of any form becomes inscribed in the land. The hills surrounding this lake and my home are worn remains of long vanished mountains. Glacial debris from the last ice age produces a rock crop in my garden each spring. Stone walls that 2 centuries ago bordered fields and pastures now thread the dark heart of forests. Lauren Isley wrote in The Immense Journey that human beings are denied the dimension of time, so rooted are we in our particular now. We cannot in person step backward or forward from our circumscribed pinpoints. I cannot touch a leaf encased in ice, nor can I feel the calloused hands that stacked these walls. Yet we make our lives among relics and ruins of former times, former worlds, and each of us is too a landscape inscribed by memory and loss. I've long felt estranged from time and place, uncertain of where home lies. My skin, my eyes, my hair recall the blood of 3 continents as paths of ancestors, free and enslaved Africans, colonists from Europe, and peoples indigenous to this land all converge in me. But I've known little of them or their paths to my present, though I've tracked long bygone moments on this continent from rocks and fossils, those remnants of deep time. The traces of a more intimate lineal past have seen hidden or lost. Yet to live in this country is to be marked by its still unfolding history, life marks seen and unseen. From my circumscribed pinpoint, I must try to trace what has marked me. The way traverses many forms of memory and silence, of a people as well as a single person. And because our lives take place among the shadows of unnumbered years, the journey crosses America and time. Come with me. We may find that home lies in remembering, in piecing together the fragments left, and in reconciling what it means to inhabit terrains of memory and to be one.
Laurette Savoy reading the prologue from her book, Trace. Go to writersvoice.net to hear the rest of our conversation. It's about Savoy's work as a scientist. You can also read more about the book, Trace, and find excerpts. That's at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon. Our webmaster is Bill Way.